Why is there a movie called Season's Greetings from Cherry Lane and another one right after it called Happy Holidays from Cherry Lane?
Cherry Lane was a movie they did last year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now they did two separate spin-offs?
So the gimmick to Cherry Lane, which actually was kind of clever, even though Rich and I figured it out within the first, 2 minutes, is that it's one house over three different time periods. So it's like you have a present day one, and then you have one from the 90s and one from the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And you don't realize entirely. At first we were just kind of that's an ugly ass kitchen. We were just kind of what a shock for a Hallmark movie to have such a dated looking kitchen. And they kind of even throw you off by the 70s family walking in and being this kitchen is ugly. We have to do something about it or something. So you sort of think they're modern and it's just a dated kitchen. But
yeah,
it's three different stories, and you find out later how they kind of overlap a little bit in some respects. So uh-huh. I guess it's just two more movies.
No, there's that three. They must be doing one for each timeline because there's Deck the Halls on Cherry Lane.
Okay. So then, yeah, I guess maybe they all
it
are
says
doing
60s, 50s, and 2090. Was it? No, this is all different times.
Oh, okay.
This is just three more movies.
Okay, so instead of it being a feature where it has three inside one movie, now it's every story gets an individual. No, but I'm saying three new more stories.
With three
but instead
new
of
times.
Intercutting them again, it's going to be each time is its own movie. Though.
No, what I'm saying is I thought it was it says in 1951, in 2003, in 2024, and then down here in 1960, in 1998, in 2015, and then down here in 1966, in 2000, and 1981. So it's three more movies with three more years.
Okay, so we're adding nine more segments to this to the
nine more
mythology
years.
Of the Cherry Lane house. All right, maybe I do have to watch these now. I'm gonna have to
the CLEU.
You're gonna have to the time. You're gonna have to make
a chart,
elaborate chart.
It's gonna be it's gonna be some fucking flow chart, going around being this character overlaps in this universe.
Not since Southland.
Not since Southland. Yes. We have a flow chart.
Episode of Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where three friends sit down with a troubled movie, a themed cocktail, and then talk about what worked, what didn't, and how they would fix it. I am Chris. I listened, Ravel.
I am Brendan, little brother, Drischler.
And I am Lee. Yes, I can draw sounds. Dalahanty.
If you weren't able to tell by our wonderful nicknames, we watched 1999's The 13th Warrior, mostly directed by John McTiernan, but there's some Michael Crichton direction in there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's mostly just starring Antonio Banderas. Kind of the list of recognizable names more or less stops there, right?
Yeah.
That guy that was Bullseye is Czech, Vladimir.
Yeah, Vladimir something.
He's a Viking. He made it look
Omar Sharif.
Omar Sharif is there briefly, but aside from that, everyone here is pretty much these are... You know,
mostly Nordic
Scandinavian,
and UK actors.
Yeah, actors whom we don't really know. So it's gonna be a little tricky.
Yeah.
Anyway,
13th Warrior is essentially it's based on the Michael Crichton book Eaters of the Dead, which is sort of a retelling of Beowulf. But hey, what if Beowulf was completely mundane and nothing was magical or interesting?
Yep. The easiest way to get me involved. Tell me it's going to be boring.
Right. Drain all the blood out of it. But before we can really get into the movie itself. What did we drink?
The drink that we made for the 13th Warrior is called Drinkers of the Dead. It was one bottle of white wine, 2 cups of grapefruit juice, 2 ounces of elderflower liqueur, 2 ounces of honey, rosemary, ginger, allspice, cinnamon, and cloves. You mix the wine, the grapefruit juice, the honey, the rosemary, the ginger, the cinnamon, the allspice, and the cloves in a large pot on the stove. Bring it just to a boil and then let it simmer for a while. Before you're serving it, you add the elderflower liqueur to the pot, let it heat a little bit more, and then serve it up hot in a mug.
What did we think?
It was good.
Yeah.
I
was really worried when I was making this because it was a fairly acidic white wine, and because it was grapefruit juice and not grapefruit cocktail, it was also a very acidic juice. And I think just having those two things together, giving off fumes as I was smelling it, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be a little sharp, I think. And I was legitimately thinking to myself, this is kind of going to be a dud, but at least we don't have that much of it to drink. And it turned out pretty well, actually, I have to say.
I mean, it did have a sharpness to it, but it was... it was kind of what I think I was aiming for, which was mulled cider, but not cider. Yeah. So it was like a wine base with like using similar spices that you might use. They're autumnal.
Yeah. Vibes. The elderflower, I think, also took the edge off and gave it a nice a nice floral note, which was lovely.
And quite, you know, sweetened it a little bit too.
Yeah, it did, which was also good because I was also worried this was not going to be sweet enough, and it turned out fine. So
I appreciate our continued. We always try to mull or have a hot drink at some point in the year, right? But I appreciate that we've been changing it up pretty consistently. Like,
yes.
I think white wine, grapefruit juice, and elderflower made for a really refreshing combo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll have to think of another one to do at some point, maybe come January, February, when it's still
chilly. Combo would even
chilly.
Look cold.
Yeah, could. It could.
Yeah. You have to figure out, like, you know, you do something different with, like, you probably wouldn't spice the wine.
Yeah, you could use, like, a simple or something, maybe, like, a spiced simple in lieu of honey.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, it was super delicious. Okay, what was this movie about?
Wow, that was great.
You just, like, you forgot what we were supposed to. Okay. All right. You're going to have to... My pronunciation or all this ancient.
I think just, I'm going to say do your best.
Yes,
I am not going to get it right either.
There's no judgment at this table. We've probably never pronounced anyone's name correctly.
Yeah. Ahmad ibn Fadlan is a court poet of the Abbasid Caliph al-Muqtadir of Baghdad until his amorous encounter with the wife of an influential noble gets him exiled as an ambassador to the Volga Bulgars, traveling with his father's old friend, Melchizedek. It's a really weird name.
It won't matter. Don't worry. You won't be hearing it too much ever again.
You won't be hearing from him that much longer. His caravan is saved from Tatar raiders by the appearance of Norsemen. He takes refuge at their settlement on the Volga River, and communications are established through Melchizedek and Hörger, one of the Norsemen who happens to speak, it says Latin, it's Greek.
It's Greek. It's definitely Greek.
It's Greek.
At times he does use Latin, though. Well, he says at one point Domini.
Well, right, well, when he comes in at some point, they're like, try this language, try this language,
try
this language.
It says trying Greek or something, yeah. From Hörger, both learn that the celebration being held by the Norsemen is, in fact, the precursor to a funeral for their recently deceased king. Hörger also introduces them to one of the king's sons, Bulvaid. That's how they say it in the movie.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Ahmad and Melchizedek witness a fight in which Bulvaid kills his brother in self-defense, which establishes Bulvaid as heir apparent. That is followed by the funeral of the dead king, who is traditionally cremated on a Viking ship set adrift with a female slave who offers, I'm sure she did, to sacrifice herself and accompany him to Valhalla, the Norse afterlife, or heaven.
I'm sure that consent was really enthusiastic.
Yeah. The next day, young Prince Wulfgar enters the camp to request Bulvaid's aid. His father, King Hrothgar, has asked for assistance as his lands in the far north are under attack from an ancient evil so frightening that even the bravest warriors dare not name it. The Angel of Death, a vulva-wise woman, says that the mission will be successful, but only if 13 warriors face this danger, and the 13th must not be a Norseman. Ahmad is automatically and unwillingly recruited. Ahmad is initially treated indifferently by the Norsemen, but they mock his, they mock his smaller Arabian horse.
However, but at least they're mocking his horse,
but
right?
At least they're mocking his horse.
So at least they respect him.
Yeah. However, he earns a measure of respect by quickly learning their language as he starts mentally translating it into Arabic. A demonstration of horsemanship and his ability to write. Bulvaid, already himself a polyglot, asks Ahmad to teach him the Arabic script, which cements their mutual goodwill. Bulvaid sees Ahmad's analytic ways as an asset to their quest. Reaching Hrothgar's kingdom, they confirm that their foe is indeed the ancient Vendel, fiends who come with the mist to kill and take human heads. While the group searches through a raided cabin, they find a Venus figurine, which is said to represent the mother of the Vendel. On the first night, the warriors Huglak and Ragnar die.
Not those guys.
I know.
Huglak?
So sad.
He held the movie together.
After a string of clashes, Bulvaid's band determine that the Vendel are human cannibals who are clad to appear like bears, live like bears, and think of themselves as bears. That's what it says.
So, I mean, more accurately, they just...
They smell like bears, they sound like bears, they look like bears, they feel
not.
Like bears.
I know I look like your mother, but I'm not.
Sorry, I'm just like they're all links, and I'm just looking at them. The first, appear like bears is a link to berserkers. Live like bears is a link to bears.
Just in case you're like, but what's
and
a bear?
Think of themselves as bears is a link to bear worship. So there you go.
Okay.
Okay. Someone simultaneously spent too much and too little time on this summary.
In case you don't know what a bear is.
Well, the thing that I saw earlier as you were looking at it up here where it says...
Horsemanship?
No, shit, where is it? Oh, there it is. Valhalla, the Norse afterlife, or heaven. And so you've got Valhalla, afterlife, and heaven all have hyperlinks. And I just love that also you couldn't just be like, Valhalla, the Norse afterlife, and have people be like, but what's that? And they're just like, or heaven, you're like, oh, okay, that one I know.
Yeah, it's pretty wacky. God.
Sorry, go ahead.
This is my favorite summary I've read in a while. The warriors' numbers dwindling, having also lost Skeld, Halga, Roneth, and Rethel, RAP, to real ones.
Yeah. One of them was pour one off, face, yeah. I think.
Yeah, pour one of your snot water buckets out for them.
By this point, the tattoo guy is dead. And their position's all but indefensible. They consult another Volva of the village. She tells them to track the Vendel to their lair and destroy their leader, specifically the mother of the Vendel and their warlord, who wears the horns of power. Bolvi and the remaining warriors infiltrate the Vendel caves and kill the mother, but not before Bolvi is scratched deeply across the shoulder by a claw attached to her hand, dipped in poison. Ahmad and the last of the Norse warriors escape the caves, but without the injured Helfdane, who opts to stay behind and fight. They return to the village and prepare for a last stand. Bolvi staggers outside before the battle and inspires the warriors with a Viking prayer for the honored dead who will enter Valhalla. Bolvi succeeds in killing the Vendel warlord, defeats them, and succumbs to the poison. Ahmad witnesses Bolvi's royal funeral alongside the four surviving members of the 13 warriors, Hergr, Weith, Etho, and Haltaf, before returning to his homeland, grateful to the Norsemen for helping him to become a man and a useful servant of God.
Okay.
Now you are a man.
Great job with all of those names.
So I don't know if you guys noticed this, but when Lee was reading through this summary, there were certain little details, like the fact that the Viking there is called Beowulf, and something called the Vendel, and the Vendel's mother. And I don't know if you guys picked up on this when we were watching this movie, but this is secretly a stealth adaptation of Beowulf.
This summary doesn't even talk about the fire serpent.
Yeah, and also it doesn't talk about whoever the hell that blonde woman is who he's getting with, who Antonio, which just feels.
But that is just
I know she doesn't matter.
Ass 90s shit where it's
he needs to have a love interest.
A woman, and then he just leaves her.
Not even a love interest.
He really
a sex interest.
He doesn't really, have any sort of closure with her.
Well, what's he going to do? It'd be like, you want to convert to Muslim? Islam? Because that's what you have
that's
to do.
That's how I do,
She does that weird thing where she just sort of, knuckles his horse as he goes by, and he doesn't even really look at her, which kind of sucks. to be very clear, Antonio Banderas is her main character.
He's a Muslim.
Kind of it. Omar Sharif was the guy with the long M... last name.
Right, Antonio Banderas' friend who disappears after, the first 20 minutes of the movie. Everyone else, honest to God, I'm going to have so much fucking trouble...
Kulich was...
...knowing anyone's actor's name and, frankly, knowing the character's name.
The guy that plays Bolvi was Vladimir Kulich.
Yeah.
Yeah. And who's the one that we like? Who's the buddy that we like?
I have no idea. What's his name?
That's the problem. I don't fucking know. Is that must be him, the Joyous, right? I assume.
The Joyous? So.
Yeah, Hergr.
Hergr.
It must be him, yeah.
Dennis, this guy, Dennis Storch. I don't know how to do the O with a line through it.
I don't know.
Finnish doesn't have the O with a line through it, so I don't know how to do that one.
But he plays, who's the guy's name? Who's the character's
Hergr.
Name? Hergr? Okay.
Hergr.
Great. Anyone beyond that doesn't matter.
Nope.
So
they're cannon fodder, almost literally.
There are 13 warriors in this movie, and I know maybe three.
Sure.
I would say.
Yeah.
I think that's bad.
Yeah.
I have kind of a hot take with this movie.
Okay.
Maybe I'll share with you. I think it's kind of a snooze and I don't enjoy it.
Wow, that is hot.
Yeah.
Bold.
Yeah. No, I would agree with you. I think especially, firstly, I think when we were talking earlier, I was the only one who's read Beowulf, the original story.
Yeah, I don't really know. I know the broad strokes,
but
I really don't know anything.
Right, I know Beowulf is, it is like this, where Beowulf is asked to come to a town, a kingdom as it were, and help them
help Hrothgar get rid of Grendel and his
brother. Grendel, who keeps attacking them basically every so often and killing all the guys.
Yeah.
He goes back to Grendel's den, finds Grendel's mother there, kills her, and then also kills Grendel. But I don't think Beowulf dies in the end of it.
No.
Or I mean like he might die, but he doesn't die as a result of, like, this shit.
No, but the end of the story ends with him fighting the dragon. And it does feel like kind of a random and disconnected thing, because the dragon's really not a part of the story until suddenly, dragon!
This I know a little bit about, because there's some guy that I watched that just does, like, these videos where he's, like, a nerd for epics like this. And apparently it's something about, like, if you acquire enough wealth and power, like, the dragon is sort of a sign of that inevitability. This is kind of the symbology of dragons in a lot of cultures, where it's, like, the inevitability is if you have enough power and wealth, the dragon will come take it.
Uh-huh.
And so it's kind of just a representation of, like, death and, like, the end that is coming for all of you. It's like, you know, you can get all this wealth and power, but the dragon
can't take it with you.
The dragon's going to get you in the end.
Yeah. Interesting.
There's also been... I was the one who kind of suggested this movie, and I did so not because I think The 13th Warrior is good, because it's not, but I do think it is an interesting angle to try to retell this story. I'm even sort of in... I would say... If this movie had, or and the book, which I have not read, but I understand this movie is extremely faithful to, with very few details being changed.
Well, yeah, because Michael Crichton's very pleased about it.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
And he was the writer, and he also did some uncredited reshoots on this. But I would even go so far as to say, on paper, if you wanted to maybe tell me a story about what might have inspired the Beowulf and Grendel myth, I'm fine with that. I think maybe the largest issue, and maybe what makes it dull, to Brendan's point, is its explanations are just uninteresting and unsatisfying.
Oh, well, it's not even that. I think there's a little bit of an element to that, but I don't think that that's inherently an insurmountable problem. I think there is a way where you could portray the cannibalistic Neanderthals dressed as bears who are representing, what's the fucking monster?
Grendel,
who are representing Grendel, as sort of a strange and bizarre reality.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to be so mundane with them as to make them boring.
Right.
Because they can still be... This is like a real world. You can still be sort of flummoxed by something happening in the real world without needing to immediately be like, my God, it's an enormous monster. You could just be like, there is something here. I can't explain what it is, but it's not something I'm familiar with. And that becomes sort of your, you know, the otherness of Beowulf that you have to contend with. Now, my issue is mostly just that I think that it doesn't have any of that. This adaptation completely kind of lacks that. It lacks anything that's sort of interesting or exciting or visually different, you know? So that's really kind of where I'm coming away from with this. Like, it's boring to me, mostly not because the answers that it posits are boring. I think it's perfectly fine if instead of... oh my God, the monster, Grendel. Right? Grendel,
it's
my God.
It's cannibals,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly, that it's a guy dressed as a bear who is a cannibal. I think that's a perfectly acceptable, like, 1-2 substitution. I just think that it's handled in such a mundane way in this movie that I don't care.
I think there's definitely room to keep it real, but to have given it some more flair, at least visually or stylistically.
The thing is, like, Vikings would have been doing this stuff all the time. They would have been sailing to unknown lands, and there would have been weird, you know, what they would have viewed as, like, barbarians or, you know, like, you know, Celts or whatever. And those Celts would have looked freakish to them and weird. They would have had paint, or they would have had horns.
Right.
You know, as, like, ornamentation. And it would have... So, like, what's so different?
Right, you should be used to things being weird.
See a guy with horns, you'd be like, okay.
It's a guy with horns again.
It's a guy with horns. It's this old story.
Right.
This old chestnut.
Yeah, and just for anyone who's following along at home and maybe hasn't seen this movie, if you were to kind of transfer the elements of Beowulf over into here, it's, like, Bwvith or whatever, however it's meant to be pronounced, instead of Beowulf. It's the Wendel... as, like, a group of people instead of Grendel the singular.
Yeah, although there is still, like, a leader. Yeah.
Right, there's, like, a Wendel mother, and then there's also a warlord, which you could identify as sort of the Grendel, like,
physicalization. Yeah, I assume,
And then instead of the dragon, they have the fireworm, but it's really just a cavalry column carrying torches, and it kind of
looks like
its
a serpent, because it's so far back.
Yeah, from the caves or whatever.
Yeah.
The other element at play here is Crichton's outfit to enter in... a Muslim scholar who was real in our world and history, and make him a witness and sort of like the storyteller here. Potentially, I guess they imply that it's his record of this happening is what becomes Beowulf, the legend.
Yeah, there's like a line where he's dying and Bolai is dying, and he's like, oh, a man could be considered wealthy if his tale was written down for people to remember him or whatever. And Amada's kind of like, yeah, that sure, you got it, bro.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. That would be a great thing if someone did that.
Heard, chef.
Yeah. You know? I'll write those sounds for you.
Yeah, I'll draw those.
Draw those sounds for you.
I mean, it's one of those things where, like, I guess they are kind of implying that, but also, like, the timeline of this movie doesn't line up with the time, mm-hmm. the actual timeline of Beowulf. So, like, you're already kind of playing fast and loose with what the story is, and that's fine. Like, yeah. I'm not saying by any means we should, like, be faithful to Beowulf. Like, I don't fucking care. Do whatever the hell yeah. you want. But I am just saying that, like, if you're seeking to make this a factual representation of things that might have happened, you're kind of also dealing with your own bullshit that you're making yeah. up here. And, like, again, that's not inherently bad. I'm just saying that if your goal is to make this seem plausible and realistic, you're already kind of not really doing that.
I know? Agree.
And so that's... I think for me, by and large, I think it's an interesting discussion to have, or like an interesting documentary to watch or an essay to read, where you talk about what might have inspired this myth, mm-hmm. where it's just sort of like, we think that maybe dragons were a thing because they found dinosaur bones and were like, oh, this must be a dragon skeleton.
Correct.
Great. Or like, you think that centaurs exist because the first time you saw a guy in a distance riding on a horse, it fucking blew your mind and you were like, oh my god, there's like a manned half and a horse half. Like, what the hell's happening here? And we're just like, oh, it's a centaur. So like, I think that's kind of neat to sort of look back and say, like, what do we think might have prompted someone to think this is the case?
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that I'm sort of coming to realization here is that I don't find an interesting movie to watch. I find an interesting sort of discussion or like a thought experiment. But if you're telling me that I'm going to sit through 90 plus minutes of this exciting, fantastical thing, but mundane and real and boring, I'm going to lose interest. It is, I think, sort of what we were talking about a little bit earlier, and we can go into discussion later. At the very least, you need to give me, like, a sense of visual style to hang my hat on, you know? And
yeah.
this does not really have a strong sense of visual style.
But I would reject the premise that this is automatic, that this premise...
Yes.
Sorry, I'm double premising. But I reject the premise that this idea is automatically boring. I think that you could have made this. I think the writing.
To be clear, I'm not saying it's always boring. I'm saying to me, it's boring.
Yeah. But I think that, like, it's not well done here because, on top, like, when you take away the fact that it's like, oh, it's Beowulf, but real, I think what's bad about it, what makes it boring, isn't necessarily just the fact that it's Beowulf, but real, but it's like, we couldn't be asked to care about any of those 10 or however, 13 minus
people.
4
yeah.
people that died.
Right.
We could barely remember the names of everyone, except
yeah.
that we just knew the one guy because he talked a lot and
right.
he was charming.
Yeah, but again, we couldn't remember his
yeah,
name.
We don't even care about Bulvi because he just kind of grunts through the movie. So, like, they didn't have characters that were that compelling. We're ostensibly sort of, like, ishmailing through the plot with Ahmad, but, like, and he is not a bad character. I think he has some interesting stuff there. But, like, I don't know, there's not enough there.
Well, I mean, it almost feels like if you're going to have, if the story is going to be told through the eyes of a character who is not arguably, quote, the most important character, you know, like in this, we'll
yeah.
presume that Beowulf is sort of the most important character.
Right.
Yeah.
You need to sort of give that character, I think, more of like a relationship
agreed.
With that so that you can like at least
yeah.
learn about the two of them.
Beowulf, Bulvi should have been the charming one.
Yeah.
yeah.
Or not. Or,
right.
or nothing at all.
Or just, but he needs to be present in a way that
have,
he's not.
He needed to have, and I guess we'll get into this in characters, but he did need to have more of the, like, presence of, oh, this is why this guy's the leader, which we don't get a lot of.
Yeah.
I guess aside from that he was the son of the dead king.
Right, I mean,
it basically
it's mostly that,
seems
but...
like, yeah, he's the strong, he's, like, strong,
right.
and he's decisive,
mm-hmm.
and that's about it. It seems like Hurger does, is, like, the sort of smart, canny one of the
yeah,
group.
Right. And definitely the way written, he has just much
yeah.
more to do.
Right, and I mean, because you also have that scene with where Hurger is fighting that one big guy in the camp, and he's, like, kind of pretending that he's losing the fight throughout much of it, and
yeah.
then all of a sudden at the end, he sort of tricks the guy into sort of bending down to cut off his own head and ducks out of the way, while the guy trips because he's falling forward because the other one ducked out of the way, he decapitates him. That's kind of, then he's at the end, he's like, look, like, this shitty little prince has been, you know, trying to figure out what to make of us this entire time, and he's been going off of, like, every bit of evidence that we've given him, and now we've shown that, like, there are unseen aspects of us to
mm-hmm.
consider as well. And, like, that's
yeah.
when you're like, oh, very
clever.
Like, that's
yeah.
a very smart thing to do.
That would have been more interesting if they had given that to Bulvi, because then that would have actually
I mean,
him feel more like
right.
a present character.
I think you're supposed to think that he has something to do with it, because you do see the two of them talking
yeah,
beforehand.
They both are on the same
right.
page.
But I do agree that, like, again, that if he had been the one to notice this and then sent out Hurger to actually do his dirty work,
mm-hmm.
I think it would read a little differently. As it stands now, it just feels like he's going to Beowulf and being like, hey, I have a great idea. And Beowulf's like, yes, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I think at the very least, you have to split the diff on the charisma between Hurger and Bulvi, or you need to just have made Hurger Bulvi. Like,
yeah,
right.
That personality grafts onto
throw
him.
Throw it onto
yeah.
the prince. I also think that in this type of story where it's like we're from the point of view character, but he's not really like the quote unquote like the protagonist per se, in the sense that he's not the hero of the story that you're telling. He's just sort of like observing it.
Mm-hmm.
We gotta go back to the beginning. I still don't know why he is there.
No, I agree.
Okay, they are exiled from the court that they were from
because he slept with the wrong lady.
They're on their way, allegedly from the summary, to somewhere else, not the Northmen's.
Right, not where they're not where they end up in this movie.
They get waylaid because they get attacked by someone else, the Tartars. And then they have to go to they get like semi-rescued by the Northmen by the fact that they showed up.
But they are within the neighborhood of where they're supposed to be, because they do say in that summary they're on the Volga River.
But that's all that happens, is they go to these Northmen after they're like sort of like semi-rescued from.
Yeah, but not like intentionally, to be quite clear also. Like they're saved by them in the sense that like their boat comes by and the enemies see them and are like, oh, not worth it. Like, let's split.
And then they decide like, well, I guess while we're here, we'll talk to the king.
Right.
And then incidentally, soon after that, it's like, well, guess what? You caught us at a bad time. We actually
need a 13th warrior.
Send out a bunch of boys, and including you, because you got brown skin.
Because we can't have a Northman.
Yeah,
because we can't have a Northman.
You know, this needs like the sort of like record scratcher probably wondering how I got that sort of thing.
But it's like, again, going back to like the Ishmael thing, like that's a decision, right? Like,
right.
There's a decision made. Like, I want to go on this.
Right.
Thing.
I'm on this boat for a reason.
Even if there's some woman saying like, oh, we need Gotham's Northmen. I feel like Ahma needs to be like, okay, sure,
right.
I'll buy it.
And I mean, it's seemingly from the synopsis, and I guess you can read this in the movie too, although the movie doesn't really give you too much detail one way or the other. He's kind of dragooned to it, according to the synopsis. Mm-hmm. The synopsis basically says, like, against his will, he didn't want to do this. So, like, again, the entire beginning of this movie is other people telling this guy, like, hey, you have to go do the thing, and he's just like, all right.
And unfortunately, that pattern sort of continues. I mean, it's not like he does nothing, but he's a very passive character.
I mean, I think they kind of imply here that, like, because he starts off the movie as, like, oops, you got caught sleeping with someone you shouldn't have slept with, that maybe he was, like, a dilettante, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah.
This is, like, so, like, there's some argument that, like, okay, that's maybe supposed to be a growth, is, like, he gets a little bite of reality.
Right.
But I still think that rather than just being dragooned into it, all it would have taken is, like, oh, Bolvai just need, like, as the new king or whatever, needs, like, to prove himself, and, like, there's some, make up some bullshit. I don't care if it's not historical anymore. Just say, like, make up some bullshit about, like, somebody needs to be there to, like, write this shit down.
Right. I mean, it almost feels like the better place to start this would be after Antonio Banderas has already been with the Norsemen for a while, and then this little prince shows up and is like, hey, I got some trouble. Will you all help me? So, like, if you, frankly, then you don't need to deal with this very kind of awkward, quickly paced and choppy opening where we have to cover so much territory from Antonio Banderas being like, I used to live here. I flirted with a woman. I got kicked out. Now I'm here with Omar Sharif. Now these guys showed up. Now these other guys showed up. And now I'm going to go talk to these guys. So it feels like if all of that was just sort of inferred or covered later on in the movie, you wouldn't even have to have that. And like, to be clear, I think this is like a destructively bad beginning for this movie.
I agree.
It's choppy. It's confusing. It's very hard to follow any character aside from Antonio Banderas and Omar Sharif.
We almost get a previously on style
montage. Yeah, literally starts with like, well,
this is what happened in the 12th War, let me tell you.
I know this isn't the case, because according to both Crichton and John McTiernan, there's maybe 10 minutes of stuff the McTiernan shot that wasn't in the movie.
Right, yes.
But it did make me wonder, I'm like, was there more?
Right, so just to, like, very briefly talk about, like, sort of the pre-production. This is, like, kind of a cursed production sort of movie, where, first of all, this movie was wildly expensive, flopped at the box office, cost a lot of money. Now, the reason why it kind of cost a lot of money to begin with is it is an epic. You know, those things do use up a lot of resources. What started to happen is that Michael Crichton was not thrilled with the way that John McTiernan was taking this movie, and effectively what started to happen is that they were both doing separate reshoots. They were kind of doing the same material, but doing it on their own. And so it basically was ending up like no one really could tell you, you know, which version this is going to end up in the movie at the end of the day.
Right.
Because, like, Michael Crichton has final say, but John McTiernan is the director. So, like, this just feels like, you know, a marriage made in hell to begin with. And then so much of this movie, like we said, just looking at the beginning, feels like there is an extra hour of movie somewhere, but apparently there's not, which is what I find the most confusing, is that it seems like there's very little that is not actually in this. So, like, you're telling me that it was always going to be this choppy, and who's, you know, I realize that John McTiernan is kind of directing under duress at this point, where, like, Disney's breathing down his neck and being like, this is costing too much money, you gotta wrap this shit up.
Right.
But, like, nonetheless, it seems like, from what both parties are saying, this is pretty much all the movie that there ever was. So, like, how is this ever going to be a better movie than this? Is what if, like, because I agree, this feels definitely like the sort of movie that got hacked up in post.
It does.
And then just sort of, like, dumped out, you know, compromised.
Especially since I would say there's multiple points where it would have only made sense to have gone further with something. So for example, like, yes, the beginning is very choppy, but one of the other long-running effects that it has is that was when we should have been understanding what's motivating our main character.
Yeah.
Or if, I'm sorry, maybe not even hero or main character, our viewpoint character. So, but we don't. We get very little. And I would even say the reason why he's kicked out, he seems like a completely different person when we actually pick up the movie and its events. I don't see a horn dog who can't control himself. I actually see someone very circumspect, intelligent.
Yeah, I just want to know more about that sort of, because I think, like, you know, you have options. Like Lee said, there's the option that he's this sort of, like, this kind of, like, dandy little doofus who, you know, like, fucks around with whatever he wants to do, nothing but the consequences until one day he fucks with the wrong woman and then he gets kicked out. You could have him be, like, sort of an immature horn dog. You could still have him be, like, a very mature, well-composed adult who just happens to pitch woo with the wrong woman.
Yeah.
But the fact is, we don't know any of those things. Like, we don't know who the fuck this guy was starting out.
Like, there's that one thing, I think it's the movie trying to 11th hour in some growth, where he does, like, at the last second, he does, like, a prayer to Allah, saying, like, sorry, I'm such a shithead.
Right.
I just want to be a good guy for the next 4 minutes of my life, or whatever. But it's like, well, how, elaborate.
Right,
how
like, is this growth to you? Like, do you believe you have grown in some way?
He says, like, he wasn't spending his life wisely or something. And it's like, well, speak on that.
Right, exactly.
Or maybe movies show us some of
that. Right, I mean, it's just that, like, we don't know anything about his life prior to this, except what little he tells us in that one scene.
I just think that his decision should be, like, a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like
I agree.
And there's options, but I agree the core premise here is that we don't know enough about where he starts as a character to understand why he should be going on this journey what he will get out of it.
Right.
Or why any of this means anything to him.
I don't know what he learned.
I don't either.
How to be a man.
Right, exactly. I mean, it really does kind of seem that way, right? Like, he learns how to hold a smaller sword.
Or to be a warrior, I guess.
But again, is that something he felt he was lacking beforehand? You know, like, is that something he wanted to have, or I don't know.
Just to get into the idea of, to really explain how a lot of the choices that it makes everything more mundane and less interesting or exciting. Here's another example of that. They're literally attacked by head stealers.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that we needed to understand every movement in that battle, but it's just so strange. That happens once. It's very rushed. We get to see the aftermath of, like, two bodies without heads, which is pretty freaky.
Yeah.
But how are we not making more of that? How are we not, I don't know, why is that not like an act one or act two kind of mini-boss thing?
I think almost every action scene in this movie is wildly rushed, and I don't understand why. Mm. I really don't.
Because, listen, that's a freaky idea. This tribe just broke in, decapitated a bunch of our guys, and then also dragged their dead bodies.
Yeah.
Out. That's freaky.
Yeah.
Why don't we spend more time with that? That would have been interesting, at least.
Yeah.
And it's a decision to know. We're not going to see the battle very clearly. We're also not going to see the bodies very clearly, and we're not going to do anything more with them.
Right.
So all of this talk about fear and monsters, where does it actually go?
Yeah.
To nothing.
I mean, well, I think the one fight scene I kind of liked is the one sort of more toward the middle of the movie where they have all of the spikes, it's like all the spikes facing out at nighttime, and then they show up with fire and start attacking. Like, that's the one action scene where I'm kind of like, okay, this is well shot. This looks good. I'm able to follow what's going on here. Every other one feels like they were trying to wrap it up in 30 minutes or so, or like 30 seconds, sorry. Because, like, especially at the end, after Beowulf kills the Gwendol, it literally is like the battle droids in episode one, where, like, the other warriors just, like, break down.
Within seconds.
Right. You hear a horn, and they all run away. And it's just, like, you outnumber them still.
It's also just silly, though, because it truly is, to bring it back to the battle droid thing, it's like their hive mind. Because as soon as the Wendell lead, like the Horns of Power guy, drops to the ground, there's immediately a distant horn.
Yeah.
Immediately the Wendell turn around and hightail.
Right.
And it's just so strange. How did you know to do that?
Right. And it's just, again, like, even if you killed this guy's leader, there are so many of these guys who will come back in, like, you know, a month or something when they've worked out who their new leader is and just start this shit up all again.
Right.
So, like, I don't understand why you really are, like, in a desperate, like, why someone's, like, tapping their watch and be like, wrap up this fight scene right now. But, like, it just feels like it doesn't even make sense.
I think, just the movie just had to move on from that scene.
Like, and, like, the Gwendol's mother?
Wendell.
I'm never going to fucking get it right. Who cares? The Wendell's mother scene feels like it's for someone who thought that it was like, that they spent too much time getting rid of Darth Maul in episode yes. one, and we're just like, no, 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 you're telling me that it took, like, 5 minutes to kill that guy? We gotta get this yeah. down to 15 seconds. Yeah. They're gonna circle each other for a while, she one slices him, he chops off her head. Yeah, and then we are done, baby. Like, why are you killing off these interesting-looking characters so fucking so quickly? Fast. They're almost not a threat to you at all. Well, I realize, yes, she kills Beowulf, but nonetheless.
I would have loved to see, like, it wouldn't make historical sense yeah. for this thing to happen, but, like, there's, like, martial art styles that were developed for, like, Asian women who had their feet bound, that where it's, like, a lot of, like, on-the-ground stuff.
Yeah.
I would have loved to see some, like, crazy snake-like
martial arts. Yeah, I think, yeah, you could have done so much exciting shit with, like, this character who looks really interesting. Like, she has her own completely unique style of fighting that, like, as soon as you know, you show up with your sword and you're like, aha, I'm gonna get you. She grabs her poison claw and, like, starts, like, crawling on the wall or something. You're like, oh, okay.
And you know what? Why not maybe you can still present it as somewhat realistic, but it just give us something weird. Give us something strange. Give us something, I don't know, just more explosive, because you're right. Well, Horns of Power guy is kind of interesting, and then the Wendell mother is interesting.
Right.
But then, like, we see Horns of Power a couple of times, but we don't, not in a way where he solidifies as a character.
Uh-huh.
And he's not someone we fear, we just recognize him as, like, one of the people that needs to die, right? And then, as you say, the mother is introduced and killed in, like, 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And what it ends up making is, this is a story about killing these monsters where the monsters are actually, like, a tertiary priority.
Right.
In terms of screen time and time we spend with them, we don't know what their deals are. We get no impression of them aside from their look.
Yeah.
But then the look isn't even really that interesting because nothing in this movie looks interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the mother looks kind of interesting. Like, I think there's some attempt being made there, you know, is what I would say. So, like, she's kind of the closest I think I have to saying that something here has a sense of visual style.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of this is just that, like, John McTiernan, you know, while obviously a talented director, is not a director who has a signature style, really.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, maybe this is just one of those movies where, again, like we had talked about briefly earlier, like Green Knight, how in many respects Green Knight feels like a better version of what this wants to be.
Absolutely.
And so, like, again, but there you have someone who has, like, a very keen, like, Lowry has a very keen sense of, like, visual composition and style and storytelling. And, like, that's what this needs. This doesn't need a journeyman director who is nonetheless very good at his job. This needs someone who has a point of view.
I agree. And then also that was not Michael Crichton either.
Also Michael Crichton shouldn't be involved. But go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's gone.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. If I think of it, I'll
visual say, style, yeah. Green Knight.
No, don't say thanks.
Okay.
We'll move on enough. I think of it. I'll come back to it.
Was there anything else we just wanted to say about, like, just in the ways that this movie fights being interesting before we get it more explicitly into visual style?
I mean, like I said, and I know we'll cover a lot of this with characters, but just, like, there's no character growth in this movie, you know, like it's just one of those things where, like, if you're not going to do X, you need to do Y, and this movie keeps going down and down, further down the list. And it's like, well, if you're not going to, like, look great, at least, like, be interesting. And it's like, well, no, we can't do that. It's like, well, okay, well, if you're not going to look interesting, you should have compelling characters. Like, no, we're not going to be doing that either. It's like, okay, then what the fuck are you doing? So you're just going to tell a story in a very literal, straightforward fashion, removing any sort of fantastical elements to it. That's kind of it. Okay, great.
Or any visual flair at all.
So, like, that's mostly what my concern is here.
I guess we were already kind of getting into, like, the bland style of things, but it really is shocking how, from camera movement to costumes for the most part, to blocking choices, to shot composition, it's all so just basic and right down the middle and kind of prosaic, shockingly so.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few moments, like I said, that I think have some sort of sense of style to them. Like, I like the part where they're on the lake and it's misty and they're lighting arrows and shooting them at the shore to try and, like, basically make a lighthouse yelling, to see where Odin. They're going. Yeah, yelling out Odin.
Cool.
For reasons we're not sure, Lee, you presumed it could be, like, an echoing thing, which makes as much sense
sounding,
as anything.
Literally sounding out.
Right, to see, like, if you're close, which, like, that makes as much sense as anything, probably. Yeah. But, like, that's, like, a good-looking, interesting sort of moment. I like the look of the Great Hall or whatever it is that the king has. Like, you know, this is shot. Where is the shot? Did you look up where this was shot?
I actually did not.
Okay.
That was kind of what
Canada, I'm pretty sure.
Go ahead, Lee.
What I was going to ask vis-a-vis the design of all of these cannibals and the mother and everything is, like, does anyone know where these Vikings lived? They had to know, were they based on any, if you decided to, like, use an actual Muslim poet, and he really wanted it to be historical. Did he, like, base the look and feel of these cannibals on any
so
tribe?
My understanding, and this is, again, I think something that is not conveyed in the movie, because I guess how could you convey it? In the book, they're supposed to be, like, Neanderthals, basically. They're supposed to be, like, a tribe of Neanderthals, like, that have managed to avoid dying out.
Some Hills Have Eyes shit.
Yeah, pretty much that, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And apparently, I vaguely looked into this, and apparently at some point, like, there was some consideration that during the time period that this movie is set in, there might have still been tribes of Neanderthals wandering. So it's not, like, wildly implausible this is the thing, but they are supposed to be, apparently, Neanderthals dressed up as bears.
Okay. To fill in, by the way, they shot this in British Columbia.
Okay. I mean, it looks great. I think a lot of the location stuff looks great. I mean, once you get to the village at the end, it tends to just be a lot of, like, mud, you know? So, like, not very interesting.
The color palette in general is mud.
Yeah, but, like, you have some nice outdoor stuff that looks, you know, decent and pretty, but...
Do we know what the deal is with Neanderthals? Were they, like, are their brains significantly different from ours?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of intelligence or language? Like, were they capable of language?
The belief was they were probably capable of communication, maybe not complex language on the level that we have it now.
Uh-huh.
And I also believe I've read before that while their brains were of a comparable size, they were not of a comparable, like, power.
Okay.
I don't know enough about, like, this topic to say anything. I can't remember. Were Neanderthals, were what, wiped out? Or was it interbreeding? Or, like, what was it? Do you know?
They just wiped.
We were better.
Okay. I couldn't tell if it was that or if it was just that we, like, started fucking them, literally, and, like, sort of became...
No, I think they were just outbred by, like, Cro-Magnons or whatever.
Okay, all right, that's...
Mad 'cause bad.
Yeah, exactly. And as we were outbreeding them, we're like, hey, get good.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, too many sweats in this. I'm dying now and fuck it.
Too many sweats.
It's my favorite. That's, like, the thing now.
To say that?
Yeah, if you're like it's like the new try hard is like you're a sweat.
Too many sweats.
Because you're sweating over the game.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that. That's
what I got out of. I got out of evolving too many sweats.
I guess, again, speaking to the whole, like, concept of finding a realistic explanation for all of these things, I don't think that's, like, an inherently terrible idea that there is a tribe of Neanderthals out there, effectively, like you said, the hills have eyes in your entire village. Yeah. Like, I think that's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other issue is, how do you convey that, though, if you don't have a character who's knowledgeable enough, as no one would have been knowledgeable enough to be like, hey, these are Neanderthals, right. Like, a tribe of, like, humanoids that we thought had been wiped out, but they're still alive. So, like, you can't have someone, like, directly speak to the audience and explain what's going on.
I mean,
but contrary-wise, they look kind of normal, aside from the fact that they're, like, have, like, black and red paint on them.
But if you look at a skull, isn't it pretty obvious it's not a human skull?
I would think, right?
It's like
Am
human,
I wrong?
It'll be like humanoid, but they're
right.
Different.
But, like, it looks different. So, like, none of these people look that different.
They were characterized by having, like, hard reaching foreheads.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, and, like, I get maybe that that's expensive to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe your special effects budget can't take that hit. But, like, if your intent is that these characters are supposed to be Neanderthals, I don't get that from
Wouldn't
this at all.
Would it just be, like, some prosthetics?
I would think.
Is that expensive?
I mean, I don't know, right? I guess, like, maybe just that...
If you don't care about, the big battles, right?
Yeah.
You just have, like, a couple characters on the screen that you just showcase.
Right. Like, you can cheat on everyone else,
yeah.
But just have, like,
I feel
a few.
Like,
yeah.
That would have added some more surrealness or some spookiness.
And I think it would also help you kind of immediately...
That do be a weird face.
Yeah, it do be weird. Yeah. And I think, like, kind of like what you said, like, if you don't know this, you just assume that, yeah, this is some weird-ass tribe of Norsemen living in a cave.
Because, like, that even some character says at some point, like, oh, it's the marriage of some beast and man. And
right.
And... Antonio Banderas rightly says, no, it's just a dude.
Right, it's a guy. Like,
he's just
weirdos. It's
he's
a
just
guy,
wearing
right.
a bear skin.
But, like,
right.
if it was a freakish-looking Neanderthal
right,
head, you might be like, that is a...
Right, and then you could even have Antonio Banderas be like, well, yeah, I thought it was a man, but, like, there's something weird about this guy.
They might be me. I mean, there would be ways, I think, to indicate to the audience that they're Neanderthals. Like,
right,
you
I mean,
had,
like Leah's saying,
yeah.
like, prosthetics are, like,
right.
such
well,
an
like,
easy thing to do.
Or just having the character be like, oh, I know them, they keep to themselves and they kind of look like us, but they seem kind of different.
I think it would have been a better thing for him to have insisted, like, nah, they're just men, and then he gets to look at one
right, close, he's like, oh no.
Oh shit.
That's not like a man I know.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, is there anything else you want to say about this? The
like,
bland style?
The bland style? No, not really. I wish it was interesting, I wish it was creepier, I wish there was more of a sense of terror in this
mm-hmm.
story, which there is not really whatsoever, you
which
know?
Is weird because I, out of curiosity, I was looking up the marketing to see, like, and I'm not saying that means anything about the filmmaker's intention, because those are commonly separate limbs doing mm-hmm. different work, but the marketing was a lot around, like, don't let fear rule you. Or and like another one, like the tagline, for example, on the poster is "An ordinary an extraordinary journey or adventure." And I'm like, those are both entirely misaligned angles for what this movie
is. Right, those are both terrible log lines, taglines, but yeah.
It just doesn't... It's not much of an adventure.
Right, I mean, like I said, what I think my intent is this was supposed to be epic with a capital E epic. Mm-hmm. You know, you're telling the story of Beowulf, which is sort of like, you know, one of our early epics, humanity's early epics that we still have. So, like, I think that's kind of what you're going for. I don't think this movie wants to be an action movie. I don't think it really wants to be an adventure movie. I do think it's almost something like Lawrence of Arabia with a vaguely more heightened sense of it, you know, like a little less realistic than that, but still striving for realism.
There are also times where I'm struggling to explain why, but it reminded me sometimes of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, because I felt like that also took what is not necessarily, maybe not an entirely fantastical story, but one that at least has a higher style and more of a sense of adventure to it, and then tried to find these like more real world gritty aspects to it.
Yeah.
And that was perhaps more successful. I mean, obviously your mileage will vary, but I kind of wondered, like, was this a thing we were doing in the 90s around that point? Like, what if we took this highfalutin story and dragged it into the mud a bit?
I was so confused for a second because it's so cemented in my brain as a one-to-one thing that when you said Prince of Thieves...
You said Men in Tights.
In my head, Men in Tights? What are you talking about?
It does remind me a lot of Robin Hood Men in Tights, actually, now that you say that.
You know, you remember how in this movie we just watched where Mel Brooks goes Fagala?
Yeah, there's a blind guy.
Yeah, Mel Brooks as Omar Sharif.
There's a blind guy with sunglasses.
I mean, I don't know if it was something that we were necessarily big on in the 90s. I feel like this is a movie that unquestionably just got made because it's Michael Crichton. And because we lived in a post-Jurassic Park world where everyone was like, what else has this guy done? Can we make a movie out of it? And it's amazing how they almost all didn't work.
Right.
Like, Congo didn't work.
Nope.
This didn't work.
Although Congo at least has the good sense to be entertaining.
Yeah, for the most part. But, like, it does feel sort of like... You want to make more Michael Crichton movies because people responded to Jurassic Park. But I think the other thing is that people responded to certain elements of Jurassic Park. They didn't just respond to, like, the Michael Crichton-y
people
of
liked
it.
Dinosaurs.
People liked dinosaurs. That's a big part of it. I think people liked the fact that this felt like a movie where you were seeing special effects, like, go with leaps and bounds into the future. Whereas something with Congo, you just have, well, it's a bunch of people in gorilla suits. And, like, they might be good with gorilla suits, but they're still just gorilla suits at the end of the day.
Well, Congo is also... I mean, I'm not trying to say Jurassic Park is, like, hard sci-fi, but Congo is truly silly town because
it's
diamond lasers and
also
apes guarding a volcano.
I can't think of Congo thinking of the stupid Texas speech thing.
Yeah.
Monkey, bad.
Ugly.
Gorilla.
Ugly.
Amy.
Gorilla.
Amy.
Yeah. Go away.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you do have that certainly as like a near sci-fi element.
I guess so. But I mean, I think that's a good point. I almost feel like maybe it's missing. I mean, it's not like Michael Crichton had nothing to do with what made Jurassic Park a successful movie. But I don't think Crichton was maybe the largest part of that success. I think you could probably say it was the special effects.
Right.
The,
well,
the
I mean, like, to be
puppets.
Fair, like, Michael Crichton had, like, gave you the hook, and it's a great hook.
Yeah.
Like, what if there was a theme park with dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Like, that's terrific. You can go from there.
Mm-hmm.
Run free, my child. I think the thing is, though, that, like, what people responded to with a lot of Michael Crichton stuff is you had movies like Westworld also and The Andromeda Strain, and people, I think, were responding to sort of, like, the vaguely sci-fi aspects of these stories, to the point that when you say, like, well, I'm going to do a historical epic based on a Michael Crichton book, I think you almost have people showing up in theaters being like, oh, Michael Crichton, the guy who did Jurassic Park and Westworld, or not even what's the twist, it's just sort of like, what's like the element, what's like, you know, like the sort of like fantasy, almost sci-fi element here, and then you're just seeing like a relatively straight adaptation,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, aggressively straight adaptation of Beowulf, as it were. And
no homo here.
Yes, no homo, no homo whatsoever, baby. And so, like, it almost
God,
just seems
good.
Like there's, like, no universe in which this movie became a success. You know,
no,
like, there is no
so.
Way this movie could have ever become a success.
Yeah, I think that's completely true.
Also, what a wackadoo. I don't understand. I mean, I think it's fun and crazy, but the choice for Michael Crichton, of all people, to be like, you know who would be really a good addition to the story? A Muslim, famous real-life Muslim poet.
Right. Well, no, that's right. That's like, I just imagine, like, this is like if I were like, I'm going to write a retelling of Sleepy Hollow and Ichabod Crane is best friends with Abe Lincoln. And it's just like, okay.
It'd be even
like,
crazier.
You can.
It would be like Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, right, right.
Get him
or it would be literally like no, Edgar Allan Poe would have been in America at the time.
Oh,
this would have been like, if you shipped over, like, Sun Tzu.
Right.
You're trans. I mean, it's like, by the way, I feel like if you're going to take a big swing like that, why not embrace less mundane aspects?
Right.
You've already inserted this person you would never have been.
I think
there.
That's kind of like the thing to it, right? It's just like you're already basically writing historical fan fiction here.
Right.
Why are you so dead set on like. And also just, I don't understand why really he wanted to lump these two disparate elements together. And again, this speaks to the book, not to the movie, which I've not read the book. People seem to like the book. I don't know. But it just seems like such like what an idea to have in your head.
Him being there doesn't matter. I feel like if it's important that he's there, his perspective should impact the story more.
Like, I agree.
He should have insights that no one else has. He should, his sort of like, his different philosophies or beliefs should maybe impact how he interprets the events versus everyone else's like, oh, it's a Grendel, and he's like, no.
Yeah, let's explore other options here. Yeah,
I do wonder if, you know, whatever is missing from that movie would have comprised more of the Muslim stuff, which we know that Disney did not want in this movie as much as possible. So I wonder if maybe he would have been not. I don't think that would have changed everything, but I'm wondering, would he have been a more present character with a perspective?
Like, even if you're cutting that out, this is still Antonio Banderas, the most recognizable name in your movie. Even if you want to trim out anything having to do with the Muslim faith, you want this character to be front and center.
I agree.
So like, you should give him something else to do. You know, like, if you're not going to talk about like the iffy background of this guy, just, you know, play up the fact that he's super intelligent and comes from a different perspective. But this movie doesn't even do that.
I had like one last thing to say before we jump over. But as we were discussing it, when you were kind of being like, Crichton's giving us like a really great hook in all of these different situations. Yeah. But maybe his like straightforward, and also maybe his priorities about what he thinks would be cool to tell a story about don't really match with ours.
Yeah.
It was reminding me a little bit. I'm not saying this is a one-to-one, but I feel like there's shades of George Lucas in there. Where I was like, what a great setup for a story. You want to do what with
it? Yeah, right. Like, you're focusing on what aspect here now?
The trade politics in the galaxy? I don't know, man.
Exactly. And like, you know, I think, like you said very much, this could just be like, my interests don't align with yours. Maybe you find it very interesting to have a Muslim character tell the story despite this character not having a whole lot of actual effect on what's happening. Maybe that appeals to you for some reason. It doesn't appeal to me, but like, more power to you. Not everything's for me. But here it's just that like, I don't understand why so many of these choices were made in the first place.
Agreed.
And then for the movie, I don't understand why they were executed in such a kind of straightforward and unengaging way. So like, if it's not for me, I don't know who this is really for.
Yeah, so I find this interesting.
Yeah.
I just clicked on the book real quick in Wikipedia. And I don't know if we talked about this or if you knew this about the book, but the book is sort of framed as like
a real world document
with like footnotes and whatnot.
Yeah, like it's a somebody like, here's this manuscript that Ahmad wrote.
Yeah.
And we're gonna talk about like, here's like some footnotes about it. There's like multiple narrators because it's like, here's like the editor of the whole thing that put this manuscript together, and here's the different translators saying, like, well, I don't know what this means.
Yeah.
Or like, I interpreted it this way, and also Ahmad. I actually kind of feel like that makes the book more interesting to sort of maybe
I'm kind of agreeing
work
with you.
Out like what's real. And I also, I feel like you would want, I feel like I want the movie to be framed.
I agree.
I mean, yeah, this almost gives like a metatextual concept to it that the movie does not have at all.
But it's
at least
more interesting, right?
Yeah.
I would like if somebody in modern day is trying to piece together what the fuck this manuscript, what actually happened.
Right.
Like, we have this manuscript. There's some shit in here that we can't make heads or tails of because he's talking about fire serpent.
Yeah.
We know that those don't exist. So what did he mean by that, etc. And like we're trying to, and so we cut back and maybe there's like some Rashomon style like hypotheses of like, well, this is what I think happened.
Right, right.
Whatever. Anyway, I just think that would maybe, you know, I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, I mean like what you're describing here. If this is what the book kind of is in some respects, like that. Presents a more engaging concept to me already from this.
Yeah.
Like, as it stands now, this is just sort of, like, too mundane of an... You know, like, it feels like it's one of those things where, like, you're getting the plot right, but you're kind of missing the tone entirely,
yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a good one. All right, shall we get into characters / actors?
Yeah, I mean, there's very little cover here because most of them don't matter.
I mean, faceless dudes.
I guess Antonio Banderas.
Right.
I mean, he's... As
he's a Muslim, right?
Yeah.
In real life.
Yeah, he's
okay. I thought so. I could never place that accent.
Ethnically, we're on point there.
Yes, and he does good accent work in this movie as he always does. Right, very convincing portrayal of a Middle Eastern man.
Like, it's just sort of serviceable as like squint your ears. Do the ear.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
It also, I think, is almost like a statement. I mean, but this is still a problem. Don't make any mistake. I don't think we would necessarily cast Antonio Banderas to play this role today, but it's not as if we're like a sparkling beacon of representation.
No. Princess of Egypt. What about that Egypt one? Was so recent.
Yeah, it sure was. Gods of Egypt
Gods
or whatever.
Egypt.
It was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, and then there was also like that Ridley Scott movie. Gods and Monsters or whatever.
No,
it was.
I know what you're talking about, but I forget the name. Yeah.
Exodus.
Yeah. It is Exodus colon Gods and something.
And
I forget what. But anyway.
Gods and Kings.
Maybe.
Then you just hired a bunch of white people to play Egyptians. Like,
right.
This is still something we do
a lot.
But I think
it's a step in the right direction to have a brown person play this character.
I mean, at least. But
yeah.
I was just going to say, it's really unfortunate that I think what they were banking on was there is so much incuriosity and disrespect in our culture for that already, that I legitimately think for some people it did not faze them to have Antonio Banderas play this character. And
I'm sure
they didn't even clock there being an accent problem for the most part, because they're like, well, what do Arabs sound like?
Well, I mean, no, I'm for sure this was literally just like, oh, who's someone with darker skin who is a bankable actor? And she's like, oh, Antonio Banderas could do this.
Yeah. I mean, and it's Antonio Banderas. He's a good actor. I think he does well, with what he's good.
I mean, yeah, like, I wish he had a character to play here, but, like, there are moments, like we talked about the translation scene,
mm-hmm.
which I think is really good, where it's just, like, a series of scenes of him listening to the Norsemen talking by the fire, and eventually, like, it starts peppering in English a little bit, because he's piecing together what their language actually is, and then he starts to be able to converse with them.
Yeah.
And, like, I think that's a well-done scene. I think Antonio Banderas plays it very well. Like, when he, like, when they're like, hey, how'd you, like, learn our language? He goes, like,
I listened.
I a lot of what he does is just having to react to things. So it's a lot of him just being like, what's happening now?
Yeah.
Like,
great face work, though.
Yeah.
Yes. But not a whole lot of, like, he's not bringing a lot to this party, one must say.
Yeah.
But not a lot of activity. I mean, he fights sometimes,
He's, by his own admission, not a warrior.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He's really there for numbers.
Yeah, right.
You know what he is?
He's a DEI hire.
He's the DEI hire. That's literally what he is. They're like, we need someone
who's not white
who's
to be part of this. So, anyone know someone who's not white
to step up? We need to please the Hrothgar shareholders.
That's like literally. I don't know why else the wise woman was like, and we need somebody who's not Northman.
I mean,
I feel like I do kind of love
how it's going to look if it's only Northman.
Once they get to the Great Hall, if like Beowulf like pulls up, is like, the king's like, good work.
Like, what is that even? At least three sentences explanation of why one of them can't be Northman.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want to talk about this guy's performance, by the way, but just a moment for the king whose performance.
Oh my god.
So funny.
Talking
like this the whole time?
Some like pre-saved Theoden energy.
Yes.
Like,
right.
Just, like dying.
You like how he's just like
just wasting away.
Yeah.
Just
like what is
like,
still my table?
I'm still in charge of what is still my table.
Yeah.
I can only be whispered to because I have no hearing.
That's right. Yeah, you gotta really stick your face right next to me.
But yeah, anyway.
Robert Morrison, How to Succeed style. You gotta really shove your head in there.
Nuzlocke.
Yeah. He's just like, hey, give me a nuzz. Come on, get over here.
Oh my god, what a great reference. I think maybe the only other person we have to discuss is... Oh, I guess there's two more people. There's Bolovar.
We gotta talk about Bolovar because he's the main character.
Right, yeah. Who, like, is...
Played by Vladimir...
Fine, like...
And not Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
Not Tim Robbins.
although...
He has a Robbins-esque...
He does have a Robbins-esque look to him.
From a distance, I was like, that's Tim Robbins.
Wouldn't that be so amazing, Tim Robbins as...
It's like, no, these Tim Robbins characters you've ever seen in your life.
But, you know, who knows what some casting director was thinking in the 90s. Man. Maybe they thought.
Yeah. As Lee said earlier, just sort of grunts through this movie. A lot of monosyllabics. It did make me wonder...
Scowls, grimacing.
Yeah.
Jaw permanently askew.
Yes.
It did make me wonder if the actor either was learning lines phonetically, so they went with short, like, clipped ones, or if he just could not speak that much English and this is what they could get.
I mean, I just assumed it was just that they had made a conscious choice to write Beowulf as sort of like a quiet,
I think this is just like what we think is a strong Norse king.
Yeah.
Just this dude with a few words.
Yeah, he's very circumspect.
Yeah.
Strong sword.
Yeah, I think this is a choice.
To the point, like, you could point a gun at me, I couldn't tell you what he wants.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I couldn't tell you about his past.
There are
he
so
wants
many...
to know how to draw sounds.
Yeah, he wants to draw sounds. And, like, that is the one moment in the movie when that happens, when he goes up to Ahmed and is like, hey, you know how to draw sounds? And
where
he's
he
like...
looked a bit vulnerable and
right.
like a character almost.
Right, yeah, it's like, okay, yeah. I get it now. Now they're, like, throughout the rest of the movie, it's going to be the two of these together in a room and, like, they're going to be learning from each other a little bit.
No,
we're like, no, you don't get fucking any of that. You see, like, maybe one scene afterwards of him writing in the sand and Beowulf being like, yep, I
but
see.
But it is also the only moment where Bolvi is like, hey, I could use help.
Right. Which is just like, it feels like, again, he should be going back to Antonio Banderas later in the movie and being like, we need some of that logic that you seem to have right here. Like, can you give us some of that or something?
Me good with sword.
Right.
Not good with...
What I also loved, though, how in that first scene... when he's like, oh, can you draw sounds? First of all, I love how Antonio Banderas plays that reaction. He was like, I can draw
sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like,
can totally draw sounds.
Like, because it's like, like responding like we would, where it's like, yes, I can write.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
that what you mean?
Yeah, right.
But I just, so that part was funny, but I do also love, so the first thing he's writing in this sand for Beowulf is some
There's
bit about there
one
being
God.
One God and it is
right.
Allah.
And his prophet
and then
is Muhammad.
Beowulf's immediate reaction is to walk away.
Yeah.
It's just so funny, where he's like, I thought I wanted this. No!
He's like, all right, proselytizer.
Yeah, exactly. Right. No, it does just feel like Antonio Banderas is like, lesson one, my God's the fucking right one here.
Yeah,
and he fails. She's like, oh, fuck it.
This isn't what I wanted.
Yeah.
I don't know. He kind of bounces right off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, he's not a character. He's just a stoic figure.
Last one I was just going to say was Omar Sharif.
Oh, I thought
no.
Her.
Oh.
Yeah.
Omar Sharif? What are we talking about our boy?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Played
her.
By...
I don't know.
We don't know. It doesn't
matter. We can't pronounce his name. It's beyond us. Dennis
yeah.
Storhoy? I don't
yes,
know. That's
I
my
don't
best
know.
Attempt.
Yeah, he's...
Herger, the one character who has a personality.
Yeah.
Yes.
He has energy. He has spark.
Yeah.
He calls
kind of the lone source of humor.
He calls Antonio Banderas' little brother.
Which is nice.
It's cute.
Which is cute. Yes, it is cute.
I don't know if they explained it and I missed it, but how does Herger speak Greek? Presumably
it doesn't
when
matter.
They
just
like landed
Greek,
somewhere.
Yeah.
He's the smart one of the group.
Yeah,
he's
I
the
think,
Michelangelo.
Right.
He does machines.
He does machines. I think, I mean, it's not inconceivable to me that, like, some of the Vikings know some random-ass languages. But, yeah, it's fine. I don't care.
Yeah.
He's
but,
really, like, he's the one who has a relationship
with Antonio
Banderas. It's not...
I love Bolvi, but we don't see much of it.
We don't. Like, we know they must, but you don't see it.
They're on the same page. They have that scene where they're basically speaking telepathically to one another.
Right.
Oh, that's a problem. Yep.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. And then he goes to challenge the big boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
and
mean,
he lived.
Yeah. Like,
which I feel like is a cheat.
I agree. I do agree. Again, he is the only character that I care about. So if you want me to feel something for the dead in this movie, you
die.
Kill him.
Yes.
What about, do you feel something for the eaters of the dead, though?
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, they're good guys.
Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
Lots of dead eating going on there.
Overpopulation is a huge problem for
us.
I did like their cave with their just like stacks of skulls.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, I liked the aesthetic. That was another success of the aesthetic.
Yeah.
Like, otherwise bland movie. Like those, I don't know how.
Like the columns of skulls.
How you
shit.
Get that?
Yeah.
How you get all these vines with skulls in them? They're supporting these skulls.
Yeah,
what's going
they're
on?
Like,
I don't know. Are you just
like threaded?
Yeah,
through?
I assume it's like threaded through somehow.
Well,
maybe
how the vines all so sturdy? And
yeah,
like, where
I don't know.
I don't know, but it looks good.
But again, like there's a choice being made, and it's an interesting choice for once.
Yeah.
So
it would be cool
hey.
If you had to go through like almost a forest of.
I was thinking like if you have to like swat them out of the way, right? Like they're just so fucking thick with heads at this point.
Yeah.
Or, like, frankly, like, I don't even know. Were some of the heads, like, the fresh heads, were they Vikings? The fans?
Yeah,
okay.
That's the thing. It should have been, he should have had.
Like, a moment of just, like, oh boy.
Should have had to walk through the heads of the dudes of his band that already died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, but again, it's also, like, because these people aren't characters, I can't track who's
exactly.
who. So, like, it's one of these where, like, I assume this is a Viking, but, like, I don't know, this could just be some other random.
Herger should have been dead by that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That should have been the last one we see.
Yeah, no, that would have worked so much better.
It would have.
And then we would have been like, that's right, kill that lady with the claw hand.
Yes.
But we don't give a shit.
No, we don't care.
Do we have anything else to say about
I mean, if you
want to
talk about Omar Sharif, it's just like,
it's Omar Sharif.
Yeah, he's
I
just
wish
like,
you were here longer.
Right, he's lending prestige to this movie, which desperately needs it. So he just shows up and is basically like, oh, here, like, have some of my clout movie, and then just splits.
Yeah.
Good job.
Well, if we, nothing else to say, we can move on to fixes. Does anyone feel like starting off?
I mean, I can start off here, basically.
It.
So, like I said, there is something about this that is kind of interesting to me, on a base level, even if it's just from a discussion versus an actual movie. But I think if you wanted to make an adaptation of Beowulf that is grounded in some sense of reality, what you kind of need is one, as I've been saying throughout this, you need a director with a sense of style. It's like you need to have a creepier, more terrifying movie. I get that maybe like you guys thought this was supposed to be an epic. I think it needs to be a little more terrifying than that. It needs to be just a bunch of people showing up in a place that they have never been before and being confronted with something that is so out of fucking left field that they do not know how to make sense of it. And so if that's something that you want to do, what I think you need to do is start approaching these earlier scenes with the Wendell. What are they called? The Wendell?
You got
great.
It.
Finally. Mm-hmm. Great. I think, frankly, when you first see them, you can really go nuts with sort of like the way you're dressing them and making them look. And you can almost like heighten what they actually mm-hmm. are, because I think it should be something that you first see these people attacking you. It's dark. You can't quite make sense of what's happening. So to you, naturally, these should very much look like weird, like half bear, half men things. Absolutely. Not just guys wearing hoods very clearly, which they are when you see them immediately, but it needs to look like some sort of monster that could not possibly exist. Then as things go forward and progress, maybe Antonio Banderas is the one who starts to say like, no, 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 look, I'm from a land where we fucking love logic and learning and reading and shit like that. I bet there is something more at play here. And maybe he's the one who first, when he has that scene in the movie, when he knocks one off the horse, and he's like, it's a man. It's a man. It's a man. It's a man. Like, that can be the moment where, like, then he looks around and realizes, like, oh, no, these are just ripped guys on horses with bear skins and little bear hoodies on.
Yeah, did you know cannibalism is great for abs?
Yeah, everyone looks fucking hot as hell. We should all start some cannibalistic diets.
For sure.
I think that's definitely something that you need to do with this movie in terms of sort of the overall look and aesthetics of it. I wish that Antonio Banderas was a more interesting character in this, and I wish he had a reason to be there. So I think going off of that, you need more explanation of what his backstory was going into this, how he is progressing throughout this, why he is choosing to be here. I think the other thing could possibly happen is Omar Sharif dies during this early scene where, you know, they get attacked by someone and the Norseman shows up, and maybe Omar Sharif dies during that. And then Antonio Banderas is just sort of left adrift. And at that point, he's always had Omar Sharif sort of looking out for him, you know, and now he's just like, well, I've got nothing now. Like, I have nothing to do. I have nowhere to go. I can't go back home because I, like, tried to fuck the wrong lady. I can't go, you know, off with Omar Sharif because he's not here. So like, here I am. I guess I'm just going to stick here and try and learn shit out. And maybe it's just sort of him kind of finding a place for himself in this right. world where he no longer has, you know, a home for himself. So like, maybe he does decide to stay in whatever the village is at the end of the movie. So like, maybe that's what his choice is, you know, like he needs to choose something yeah. in this movie, which he does not do. So like, I think you can sort of definitely play around with him still being the narrator and sort of the focal character, but he needs to have more of a spine to himself. He needs to interact more with Beowulf. And I also just think, lastly, real quick, that you have 13 warriors. It is not insane that at least half of them be distinguishable or yes. have a personality.
Yes.
Like, Lord of the Rings manages to do this pretty mm-hmm. well, I would say. Even The Hobbit does it better than this. And in The Hobbit, it's like half of them look exactly identical, yeah, but at least yeah. there I can be like, oh, like, he's sort of like the best buddy to the king. He's sort of like the body old one. He's the
right,
hot one.
Right,
and
right,
so it's
right.
like, just give me literally one thing for every character to hang their hat
like the
on.
Seven dwarves yeah. dopey
yes, yes.
Sleepy.
One is dopey, one is sleepy, one's a medical doctor
yep.
yeah that's all I want. And maybe like, you know, maybe that makes this movie longer than 97 minutes, so be it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
do you want to go next?
Sure, I'll go next. Yeah, I think I've talked about, I think we've all kind of hit on the things that are wrong with this movie, and I think there are a lot of ways to fix it, and I'll just I'm just gonna freestyle grab bag any number of those fixes right now and make one possible.
I'm Lee Delahanty, and I'm here to say it's fun to fix in an improvisatory way.
I really like the framing narrative, but I think it's too late to throw that in, so I'm gonna leave that. I think the framing narrative is a really fun way to do this, but I'm gonna stick with another one. I would like his motive to be that he wants to be this great poet, but doesn't feel like he hasn't like earned that sort of like right or that story. Like, he's maybe looking for something to like a hook or something, and I think that gives him the motivation to say yes to this crazy request of like, hey, we need a 13th mm-hmm. guy to come kick some ass, and he's like, sure, I can do that. There's 12 other guys; they'll handle mm-hmm. that, and I'll just sort of like witness it and like I'll have a cool story by the end of it, and I'll be able to write about it or whatever, and then maybe I can go home and they won't like I'll be like forgiven because I'll be such a cool poet with a cool story that they'll let me back in.
Little do you know.
Yeah. Little did I know. So he goes with all of these Norse guys. I like that there is still like the translator character, so I think we just split the difference, or maybe give Bolvi a different fun personality. I think again maybe we can beef up this like mentorship, so that it's like Herger is kind of like big bro to Antonio Banderas, and then Bullseye is more like Antonio Banderas is kind of helping him become more kingly with like filling him with like stuff that maybe he doesn't need. He doesn't have like how to write or do other things or like be more maybe diplomatic, which is maybe like he's a good warrior, but he's not a good diplomat. And that's kind of what ostensibly Ahmad is meant to be doing in the first place, is be a diplomat as an ambassador. So it's like, okay, well, I'll help you speak better, do all this shit.
It's easy to forget that, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It is easy to forget that you're supposed to be an ambassador. So there's kind of like a weird love triangle of mentorship happening where it's like, I'm learning how to be a warrior from this guy, and mm-hmm. I'm teaching this guy how to be a good diplomat or whatever. What I think I want to happen with the spookiness of the story to make it more like compelling is that I think that the Hills Have Eyes people have like not poisoned, because that's something they're supposed to be eating, but mm-hmm. I think that they've like spiked the water supply with some sort of like psychedelic drug or some sort of drug that makes people more susceptible to hallucinations. And so I think they get there and everyone has these crazy stories of like, it's fucking nuts, you know? Yeah. I see these crazy ass things. And it's like a fear tactic that these people have done in the past. Like they can make them, they know that it gives people like bad vibes, like bad trips. And mm-hmm. so they're using it to sort of make them more easy to kill and hunt and also drive fear into their hearts. And so at first, like the 13 warriors are like, this is nuts. Everyone here is crazy. And then, you know, gradually they're drinking the water. So then they start having the craziest vibes happen. And so that way you can have like scenes of like, he can see like a line of cavalry lighting down, but it looks like a fucking fiery snake coming down mm-hmm. a mountain. Like, it just looks crazy. Obviously, this requires a special effects budget, which maybe you don't have in this time period, in this day and age. But, you know, if we have carte blanche, if we have Cate Blanchett with the budget.
Carte Blanchett.
Yeah, if we have Cate Blanchett with the budget, then you'd have, like, some time to do some cool effects, right. Whatever. I think some of those low-light scenes with, like, the, oh, it's nighttime and we don't know what's happening, I think a lot of shadow work would be really clever mm-hmm. to have, like, the shadows of the, with the stuff, the horns or whatever, be, like, really monstrous looking. And you just have, like, a shot of Ahmad looking at, like, a reflection or a shadow cast, being like, what the fuck am I looking at? So, yeah, you would do it that way, and it does just amount to, it's this happening again. And then, yeah, I think in the end, I think the translator dies is one of the last before they get to the lair. And I like, again, because I said this during the recording and I liked it so much that like you have to wait, they have to walk through all of the skulls of their fallen brethren and the last one's Herger. And yeah, and I think Bullseye dies during it. I kind of like the idea because we have a POV character and he's not Bullseye, but I kind of like the idea that he has to go with Bullseye into like the lair.
Mm-hmm.
It is like a close fight, but because Bullseye gets like slashed with the thing, he like maybe falls for a second and Ahmad has to deal the killing blow to the mother or whatever. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't, like, we don't tell anyone that.
Yeah.
We let Bullseye have the glory because he's the king. And it's sort of a secret that Ahmad takes, like, to the rest of it. He, like, writes it down as, like, Bullseye doing it. And we still have Bullseye doing the guy. Like, he's poisoned up, but he still, like, kills the horn, the keeper of the horn, whatever the fuck. So that you give Ahmad, like, a growth arc and a hero moment, but also a growth arc where it's like, well, it's more like, I think it's more important for the story. It's truer to the story that like this guy who like had the bravery and the courage to lead us all gets all the glory for doing this, and that I keep myself separate from this narrative. That's my fix.
Nice. All right. So my thinking was this movie, similar to something Brendan was saying, needs to be a lot scarier. I think the concepts it's dealing with are naturally kind of scary, but the movie makes choices that completely defraze feeling at all scared or struck by that. So in my mind, this needs to be more like Green Knight. This needs to maybe even have elements of Sleepy Hollow, or, and I know this was a pod movie, so it's not, you know, entirely a great example, but like Brotherhood of the Wolf, where I don't think you necessarily have to choose the boring reason why these things are this way or go a completely fantastical version. I think, especially, almost like in The Witch, how like, was that stuff really happening? Who knows? But someone who's viewing the world who genuinely believes in these gods and these monsters and these things, they would view these people in a certain way. So I think while eventually you may have Ahmad realizing like, oh, these are guys in bear suits, for example, similar to what you were saying, I want the initial visuals to imply that these are kind of like other creatures.
Yeah.
I'm fine with there being a team of cannibals, but I do think we need to spend a lot more time with their leader, the Horns of Power guy. My thinking was that the mother is alluded to and spoken of, but is really just some kind of like disgusting idol that's being maintained in the cave where they're living. My thought was the reason why they're collecting heads so often is those are like a constant offering he feels he needs to make to this figure that he calls mother. Mm-hmm. I think you could also play with that to have it be like, maybe this was like a disused Roman temple and this was like a statue that got left behind and now this image or this icon is being reappropriated in this way. Mm. I'm fine with having, I like having Ahmad there. I think he has a cool and like different presence to give. I just think he needs to be a much, much, much more active. I think maybe you play up the difference of he legitimately knows about like science or chemicals. Maybe like he's able to figure out an antidote to a poison that would have otherwise killed one of the people in the group after like a cannibal attack. I also just think that you need to bring in a lot more visual height to this. I think we need to be seeing bones. There's this really freaky video game called The Forest, and in it you're basically trying to defend your little encampment from an increasing number of like crazy mutants that just come out of the woods and they're really strange.
You want the spider vagina leg lady?
Don't want that necessarily, but what I was thinking is there's a creature in there where it looks like a humanoid creature with many arms and it's sort of tree-like. I think there would be a way to approximate that in a more realistic way.
Yeah.
Maybe Grendel has literally severed the limbs off of enemies and tied them to him to make himself look bigger. A lot of times, especially if this is an animalistic cannibal cult, a lot of times animals will try to make themselves look larger to be more intimidating. I think that would be a really effective fear thing to do. I think we need to be playing with light and shadow and silhouettes a lot. And I think that should definitely be how these people get introduced so we can really sell the idea of that they're potentially monsters. I have no idea how I would adapt the dragon in a way that would be short.
It almost feels
monster.
Like you don't need the dragon, right? The dragon doesn't matter in this movie.
No.
In this adaptation. So, like, why even bother?
I would say, like, maybe if you squint, maybe somehow someone got, like, a monitor lizard or something.
No.
And, like,
I mean, like, I think it could be, like, if you really wanted to go nuts, you could almost just have it be, like, a Trojan horse-style creation that they set on fire and, like, launch at them as just a means of, like, knocking down shit. Or, you know, or setting their entire village on fire. Like, if you wanted to, you could do that. But again, the dragon doesn't fucking matter in this version.
Like, I think the framing device should be Antonio Banderas is back in the court of his original caliph.
Mm.
And he is trying to tell a story that is worthy enough to explain why he's back and why he should be let back in. Because he's like, listen, I've traveled and I've also learned all this new shit. We think of ourselves as being, like, high above all these people. And yeah, I kind of feel like these people were barbarians, but they taught me a lot of stuff that we didn't know. And I think maybe you could also get away with, if you wanted to leave some things more fantastical, more inflated, more heightened, then you kind of already have that cheat of, well, this is a story he's telling. He's naturally embellishing. Mm. He's trying to use his poetic flair to inject some, like, drama into it.
You could also have easily spun his being exiled as, like, some other, you know, whatever.
Any number of things.
It could have been, like, it could have been some sort of, like, comeback when you've, like, learned some
right.
shit.
Right, yeah.
He's like, I learned some shit.
Right,
or
right.
Or you could be, like, the old caliph was deposed, and so his administration went with him. Like, you know, who knows?
Mean, there's, like, even just, or, like, you're a scholar, you want to learn shit, so, like, go out and learn shit. Like, there's so many fucking things you could have done instead of just having it be tossed off, like, oh, you tried to sleep with this woman who you shouldn't have slept with, but, like, why? Is that bad? Like, what does that say about you?
It just has so little to do with what we see of that character. But yeah, last question, my friends. Mm-hmm. Would you recommend this movie?
No.
Nah. I mean, I'm interested. I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone else needs to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I agree with that.
Yeah. This is not a terrible movie, but this is definitely like 2 out of 5 stars for me or something.
Yeah.
It's not a complete mess, but
if you're like an Antonio Banderas head, if you're if you're a Band-Aid,
or if like you are just unnaturally interested in the concept of Beowulf for some reason,
I think it's more interesting than it is entertaining.
Yes,
more interesting than it is good.
Yeah,
and I would even say a lot of what's interesting about it is more conceptual.
Yeah,
and knowing that the framing device was a lot more clever in the book, that does seem more interesting. Like you could almost leave it up to the reader to what extent you decide to believe.
Yeah, you're losing a lot of that in the movie by just
definitely
a dry retelling of this.
Yeah. Well, that, as we say,
is that
as 13th wire.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we put him with the
What?
Should we, you know. that was really fun. We'll come back in 2 weeks.
Oh, I don't know. Aren't you the host? Shouldn't you be hanging with us?
He never knows it. He's trying to throw to you.
Yeah,
you
I guess he's... Yeah,
I never remember the socials correctly.
So come back at us in 2 weeks. We'll be doing a mini episode where we also talk about what our Christmas celebratory movie will end up being this year. We'll have figured it out by that point. So please listen in. We'll talk about a drink for it too. We have a website, dratpack.com. We have facebook.com/whywitchpodcast is our Facebook page. That's pretty much all you need to know as far as that's concerned. You can subscribe, like, rate, what have you, to the podcast on all of the normal apps, I believe.
And so I guess we'll buy it out Viking style? No.
No, we'll just buy it out.
Just buy it out.
Bye! Bye. Okay.